Well, this morning we come to one of the most pleasant books of the Bible, the book of Ruth. And for us, perhaps, it's especially pleasant because after so many long books of the Bible and books that are filled with shall we say, not so pleasant experiences, it's nice to come to a simple story, simple love story, where there's nothing in here that I wouldn't want my kids to read, even if they were in their teens, early teens. It's actually a very expertly written book. So I'm told from people who know Hebrew a lot better than I do. They say that the story is really a just a wonderful example of Hebrew literature. Short, simple, but it's like every word in the book has a purpose, and you just have this feeling that every word is exactly the right word that it's supposed to be. Our picture is rather pleasant too up here. It shows a blue roof on the house. Reminds me of the dog who could answer trivia. So his owner said, he asked him, what's on the top of the house? And he said, roof. And he said, what's sandpaper like? And he said, roof. And he said, who is the best baseball player ever? And he said, roof. And his friend said, he doesn't know anything. The best baseball player ever is Mickey Mantle, but shows what the dog knows. But the roof is covered there, or colored there in blue, because, in fact, there's a book, if you look closely at it, that's a book that is the roof of the house, to remind us that the name of the book is Ruth. And on the second floor of the house there, a young man and woman sitting on the sofa, obviously in love. They're on. They're not on the first story. They're on the love story of the house, because Ruth is a love story. So, I really almost feel like apologizing when I try to explain how these pictures remind us of the main themes of the book. But it does help us to remember that the book of Ruth is a love story, and that very simply, that's what it's about. A lot of lessons that it teaches us. But at heart, it's just a simple love story. And so I'd like to begin this morning by reading the first chapter of this love story. It does a good job of setting the stage for the story. It lays down some of the themes that will become important as the story goes along. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name Naomi. The names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah. They went to Moab and lived there. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they had lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and without her husband. When she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband." Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, "We will go back with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Return home, my daughters, for why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband this night and gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. At this they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and to her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred up because of them. And the women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. One note I want to make on this. Some of you are saying, what's the point there where she says, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. In Hebrew, names are words. Or they're very so similar to words that when a name is spoken, you think of the word that the name is associated with, like Moses. They called him Moses because he was drawn out of the water. And here the word Moses either is the word for to draw out or sounds very close to it. Well, the name Naomi means pleasant, just like I was saying how pleasant a story this is. And the word Mara means bitter. And Mara also is a very common name. You may think it's odd for someone to call their child Mara, their daughter, a bitter. But then we think on the fact that Malan, one of her sons, his name means weakling. So how would you like that, men, to have a name that means weakling and everybody knows it? Or to be like a Benjamin, whose mother wanted to call him Son of My Sorrow, because when he was born, she was dying. And fortunately, his father, Jacob, was kinder to the boy and named him Son of My Strength, which is what Benjamin means. So names back then could be very descriptive, even to the point of being cruel. And so Naomi is almost renouncing her birthright, so to speak, because of the experiences that she's been going through. And I don't want to really say too much about that because, you know, it'd be very easy for me to lift up Naomi and say, look at how little faith she had. Here she was in Bethlehem, and when things get tough in Bethlehem, what's she do? She moves, not to another place in Israel, but to another country. She moves to Moab. And God told the Israelites not to do that. When they conquered the land, God said, now you settle in the land. If anything bad happens in the land, it's going to be because of something you have done. And so if you will live as I have called you to live, you have nothing to worry about. And if you have distress, all you have to do is examine yourselves and ask, where have we turned away from God? But don't be going to Egypt and don't be going to your neighboring countries for help. Come to me for help. But things get rough for Naomi and her family, and what do? They go to Moab. If I was her, or if I was her husband, I might have done the same thing. Food is a very strong motivator. Then she finds out that there's food once again in Bethlehem, and so they return to Bethlehem. But look at her attitude toward God. Her attitude is very bitter. And the first thing I would have to say is, I can understand that. I can see where her attitude would be bitter. She lives in a nation that was founded on the idea that God would be her protector, her provider, that God would see to all her needs. Well, here God has obviously dropped the ball. First he caused the famine, then he took her husband from her at a young age, Then he took her sons from her, and there are very few pains that cut as deep as losing a child. A person, a grown-up, is resigned to the idea, if they're married, is resigned to the idea that one or the other of the married couple is going to lose their spouse. One's going to die first, and the other's going to have to live with it. Even those who are unmarried have friends, and they know that friends don't last forever. Sooner or later, either I will die and cause my friends hardship, or my friends will die and cause me hardship. But you don't expect to have to bury your children. And you don't expect to lose a friend weeks or months after making a friend. You expect to have them around for a while. So not only did God cause the famine, which led to her distress in the first place, but he has taken her husband, and now he has taken her sons. And all she's left with are two strangers. Because how many mothers-in-law really get along with their daughters-in-law? I mean, that's a source of jokes for how many comedians' careers have been made by having a good stock of mother-in-law jokes to fall back on. And so all Naomi has left is two daughters-in-law. But apparently the relationship between Naomi and her daughters-in-law was pretty good. Because when she decided to go back to Bethlehem, her daughters-in-law decided to go with her. And it was only after basically pleading with them that one of them, Orpah, decided she would in fact remain with her own people. But Ruth provides us with the example of the convert. Everyone says if you want to know what Christians believe, don't ask someone who's been a Christian all their lives. Ask a convert to the faith. And I suppose that's true. I had an aunt, my mom's sister, who married a Catholic. And in my family, in my mother's family, that was, oh, don't do that. And she said, don't worry, he's Catholic, I'm not. But eventually, She became comfortable with the Catholic faith, and of all the people in her church, I bet there wasn't a one who was as staunch a Catholic or as devoted to the Pope as she was, because she was a convert, and converts are like that. A convert asks the questions that everybody else takes for granted. A convert will ask, for example, I can imagine Ruth being a young woman with a lively imagination and an interest in things other than what am I going to eat today, asking questions that none of us would think to ask. I can imagine her husband, I'm assuming it's Malin, might be Killian, I'm not sure which. Anyway, I can imagine her asking her husband, why do you believe this about God? Or why do you do this? Or why don't you eat this food? I don't see anything wrong with ham. Why don't you eat ham? Why don't you ever drink milk at the same meal that you're eating beef? Why do you do these things? And I can see her husband saying, will you just shut up and eat? Because he doesn't want to ask those questions. Maybe to him it's a burden to begin with, but he does it because that's what the law requires. But she's curious because she knows what God was hoping the Israelites would know. She knows that if the Israelites do something, there's a reason for it. That God's not just being nasty when he says, don't eat this food and worship in this way and offer this kind of sacrifice. There's a reason for it. And that the whole purpose that God had for doing these things, for having these laws, was to encourage his people to ask the right questions so that the law could explain the answer. Remember the Passover service. We've had a couple of them here in our church in connection with Holy Thursday. And remember when God instituted the Passover, what he said to the fathers. He said, now when your children ask you, why are we doing these things? This is what you are to tell them. What God is doing is he's creating what we call the teachable moment. He's creating a situation in which the questions will come naturally and the answers can be given. All of us who are parents or who have ever had to teach something to children or even to fellow adults in the workplace know very well that you can explain something to someone 5 or 6 times over and they'll never catch it. But when they ask you the question, how does this work, and you explain it to them, one time is all it takes. If you get them curious enough to ask the question, then the answer becomes much more powerful. Well, the famine that led Naomi to Moab in the first place was meant to be one of those teachable moments. It was meant to cause the Israelites, particularly the people in Judah, to stop and ask the question, why isn't God providing our food? He promised that he would. Why isn't he? And then through prayer and through dialogue with one another and through going back to the law of Moses, they would understand why God said that if we worshiped other gods, if we made idols for ourselves, if we mistreated our neighbor, that he would have to discipline us. Every father in the community would say, well, if I were God and I had set these rules and the children had broken them, I would discipline them. That's all God is doing to me. It's discipline. But the people of Israel didn't ask the question. So the teachable moment went and they didn't learn anything. At least Naomi didn't learn any, Naomi and her husband didn't learn anything. But look at the difference between Naomi and Ruth. If anyone has the right to say, don't call me pleasant, call me bitter, because God has been bitter to me, it would be Ruth. Imagine what she did in marrying a foreigner. The people of Moab and the people of Judah did not get along. I mean, this is the beginning of the problems that we have in the Middle East to this day. Can you imagine an Israelite in Israel today, a Jew in Israel today, marrying a Palestinian? Can you imagine the conflict that would stir up in their families? Well, Moab and Judah did not like each other because Judah conquered some of the cities of Moab and some of the territory went to one of the tribes of Israel. And there's an artifact that was discovered by archaeologists a while ago in the land of Moab. And what it is, it's a record of a victory that the Moabites had over the Israelites, and it celebrates the massacre of several Israelite cities. They didn't like each other. They didn't get along. And here is Ruth, a young woman, marrying a guy from Judah. Can't you hear her family saying, what, aren't there enough guys in Moab that you have to take a foreigner and a Judite to begin with? After all, they're people that kill our people. So Ruth goes to all the risk of marrying and even adopting the gods of the Israelites. Look how God treated her. God robbed her of a husband at a lot younger age than Naomi was when she was robbed of her husband. Ruth went to all the trouble of changing her gods. Don't you think maybe she could have looked at her bad circumstances and said that maybe the gods of her fathers were punishing her for switching gods on them? Don't you think if anybody had a right to say that God had been bitter toward them, that it would be Ruth? And yet you see no complaints at all from Ruth. Naomi is like the person who's been a Christian all their life and have gotten so comfortable with God that they complain about him all the time and don't even realize how they sound. The only words that Naomi has spoken so far are words of bitterness and complaint. She says to her daughters-in-law, God has been much more bitter toward me than toward you. Well, wait a minute. You had your husband a lot longer than we had our husband. But you know, people who are bitter tend to be like that. They tend to think that their sorrow and sadness and pain goes much deeper than anybody else's. And that gives them more right to complain than others do. And so Naomi is, I mean, she is really bitter. She might not admit to it. She would say, no, no, God's the one who's bitter. He has been bitter toward me. I'm not bitter. I'm just the poor victim. But she's very bitter. In a way, the new faith of Ruth changes the old faith of Naomi. Naomi is bitter through the whole book until we get to the end. Ruth, whenever we hear from her, what do we see? We see a young woman who's like, well, this is life. Let's make the best of it. I need to study Ruth a lot more because I could develop that attitude for myself. She's like, okay, this is the situation I'm in. How do I deal with it? Forget about what came before. Don't talk about God being bitter toward me. This is the situation I'm in. What do I do about it? She goes home with Naomi because she's committed herself to Naomi and Naomi's family. She took it seriously when she made vows to her husband. She laid aside her family and her gods, and she accepted the family of her husband and the gods of her husband. And it didn't matter whether her husband was living or dead, she made a promise to him. Now, I'm imagining the situation here, but I don't think I'm too far off. Why else would she have remained with Naomi even after Naomi gave her permission to leave? And now that she's back in Bethlehem, a place she'd never been before, but probably she's heard horror stories about it, growing up in Moab, about how the people of Judah live. And what does she do? Ruth says to Naomi in chapter 2, let me go out to the fields and pick some leftover grain. See, back then, there was a much nicer way of living, I suppose. The reapers were commanded by God not to get every stalk of grain in the field. But to reap carelessly, so that the poor of the land could follow behind the reapers and gather up whatever they didn't get. And that's what Ruth did. She says, well, I'm poor, I have no money to buy. I'll have to go out and work for what I get, and so the way I can feed my family, my new family, my mother-in-law, is to go out in the fields while they're reaping and go behind the reapers and gather up what I can. And we're told that she was busy the whole day. You know, she strikes us as someone who says, well, I got work to do, and she goes about it, and she does it, and by the end of the day, she's got a lot of grain. In fact, her attitude toward her mother-in-law is such that when Boaz finds out about it, he says, I've heard about how kind you are to your new mother-in-law, to your newfound family. Now, Boaz could have said, you're a foreigner. He could have ordered her back to Moab. We don't deal with your kind here. It was probably against custom, if not against the law, for Naomi's sons to marry foreigners in the first place. You know that they're only supposed to marry within their tribe. Boaz could have been very bitter toward Ruth. But instead, he saw the way she had treated Naomi. And he saw through the outward appearance, through all the words that we use to categorize a person. This is their race. This is their origin. This is their economic level. This is this, and this is this. He saw through all of that. He saw into the heart, and he saw the heart of a beautiful woman. Here is someone who knows what love and compassion and mercy are all about. I can almost imagine Boaz being the same kind of person as Peter. Remember Peter from the book of Acts? He got word from a Roman centurion, a Roman army leader. I'd like you to come and talk to me about your faith. Any number of other Christians at that time would have refused the offer. We don't need to go to a centurion. Let them have their own, for the Romans have their own gods, let them go. They're going to hell anyway, because they're destroying our nation. But not Peter. Of course, he has a dream from God, and the dream helps to encourage him. But when he gets to Cornelius' house, and he says to Cornelius, why did you send for me? Cornelius says, well, I had a dream. And in my dream, God came to me and said, go to such and such a town and such a place and ask for a man named Simon, whose name is Peter, and listen to what he has to say. And Peter says, in Acts chapter 10, verse 34, Peter says, I now know how true it is that God does not show favoritism, but accepts people from every nation who fear him and do what is right. Ruth was living a life that revealed a heart of gold. Boaz knew, here is a woman you don't find every day. And so when he had the opportunity to propose to her, he realized that there was one other family member who had a claim to Ruth and her property that was higher than his. And in order for everything to be done properly, this fellow needed to be offered Ruth and her possessions before Boaz would have an opportunity to ask for them. And so he went to this fellow and he said, well, you know our kinswoman Naomi. She went off to Moab and her, yes, I know the story. Well, they've come back now. You know, her sons are dead. Yes, I know. Well, the son's property is available. If for the next, for the closest of kin, and you're the closest of kin, and the property is available to you. And the guy's eyes light up. Property, you know, that's money back in those days. Sounds good, he says. And Boaz says, yes, but you'll have to realize that along with the property goes the widow of the dead man. Her name is Ruth. And this guy says, oh, no, not interested. Why was he not interested? Because in his eyes, Ruth represented somebody else's property. Any family that he had with Ruth would not be his family. It would be carrying on the name of her dead husband. And he'd be like sacrificing his legacy before he even got started. So he says, no, I don't want the woman, so I guess I can't have the property. And Boaz, I bet he just breathed a sigh of relief. One man looks at her and sees only the bottom line. He looks at everything on the surface and he comes up with a conclusion, she's not worth having. Boaz looks in the heart and he sees something so valuable. He wants to make sure he does everything properly in order to obtain the prize. So that once he has the prize, no one can come along and take it away from him. Say that he got it improperly. He sees the heart. On the outside, she's a Moabite. She's a foreigner. She's another man's widow. For some people, just the thought of being a widow, it's like some people, I've heard some people say, I'd say to them, yeah, we're going to have to look at our will now because, you know, the kids are grown up and so we have to change it a little bit. Will? Oh, don't talk to me about wills. I don't want to hear it. Well, obviously, this other kinsman, when he heard about Ruth, you know, don't talk to me about another man's wife. I want my own woman. I want my own family. If I marry her, it will threaten my property and its status. When Boaz looked at Ruth, he saw through all of that. He saw straight to the heart. Ruth is really more an example of what God called his people to be than anyone else in her family. Naomi or whatever we know about her father-in-law, maybe even than the two sons. Ruth is an example of simple trust and faith. Naomi is an example of entitlement and bitterness that comes when you don't get what you think you deserve. And yet Ruth lived with that She loved the woman who was bitter and was devoted to her. And she loved that woman's God, even though that God had not been very kind to her in the circumstances of her life. She did what she was called to do. She did it with all of her heart. She did it for the sake of others, not for herself. What better example of a Christian could there be? And I think one reason this book is in the Bible is because God's sort of pricking us a little bit and saying, now if here's someone who just became a member of the family of faith, she grew up all her life in a foreign environment, and if she can love me with such devotion, if she can have such a heart of compassion toward others, then maybe she'll become an example for you. The two things God said were most important in life, to love God and to love your neighbor, Ruth demonstrates them both. She left behind the false gods and devoted herself to the one true God, the God of Israel. And she showed devotion to her mother-in-law that was greater than any of the kinsmen had shown to Naomi. In fact, I imagine they were kind of happy that Ruth was there, because if she could take care of Naomi, the rest of them didn't have to. What an example Ruth becomes for us. And you know, one last thing that I notice in this book of Ruth when it talks about it, Ruth is such a, her character just glows through the chapters, through the pages of this book. You know, one thing the book never tells us about Ruth, the book never tells us what she looked like. The book doesn't even tell us that the sons of Naomi married attractive women of Moab. It just says they married. We don't know anything about Ruth. We don't know what she looks like. Don't know how tall she was. Don't know what color hair she had. Don't know what her measurements were. All the things that young men are probably looking at when they're looking for a possible mate, you know. When Boaz looked at her, there's no indication that he even noticed what her outward beauty was like. Because everything he talked about had to do with how beautiful her heart was. How well she had taken care of Ruth. How devoted she was to Naomi. How devoted she was to the God of Naomi. These are the things that Boaz noticed. These are the things we must teach ourselves to notice. We must learn somehow how to purge from ourselves the bitterness that so easily settles in the heart. How to cleanse it out, just like that gunk that fills the pipes in the house. And every now and then you got to either pour stuff down the drain, or you got to take that elbow out and clean the grease out of it. That stuff just collects there. Megan was having trouble in her tub because the water wasn't draining very fast. And so the maintenance man came right away. Maintenance man came, and he cleaned out her drain. It was full of hair, of course. Just how easily. She says, well, now I know how to clean it myself. Because it happens, you know. It collects after a while. That bitterness collects in our hearts, and we have to consciously purge it from us, or it takes over our lives. We have to consciously devote ourselves to God, trusting that whatever He sends our way, He will teach us why, and He will help us through. And it will all be for our good, whether it looks that way or not. What simple lessons from Ruth. What an example of simple faith and trust and simple love for others. I tell you what, if I could live up to half of that reputation of Ruth, I'd be happy. And the good news is God tells me, David, I know that your heart isn't like that. I know that there's bitterness there. I know that there's selfishness there. I know that there's all these other things there. But you know, with me, I can change the heart. And that's where we begin. I will change your heart. And then you can learn the lessons that Naomi demonstrates. You can learn the lesson of devotion to God. You can learn the lesson of devotion to others and love for others. And living with a simple beauty that can't help but affect the hearts of those who are around us. They can't help but notice it. Here's a woman who's, she's quite a prize. And God is saying, we can be like that too. He can change our hearts. He can give us a heart of love and tenderness toward others. He can help us get rid of that bitterness. That's what the Christian life is meant to be. An opportunity for us as time goes on to become more and more like Ruth, more and more like Christ. Heavenly Father, we pray that this would be true for us, that in spite of whatever bitterness may be in us, in spite of whatever selfishness may still be in us, through your Spirit you are able to purge us of all evil and all sin, and you are able gradually to help us to live toward others with the same heart of gold as Ruth showed toward Naomi. May this be true for us as well. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Would the ushers please come forward for the offering?